From the day we were born, LGBTQ people are often at odds with a world that doesn't understand or appreciate who we are. Like a phantom menace, this shame follows us even though as adults we're out and proud. Queer folks face significantly higher rates of depression, anxiety, and drug and alcohol abuse. Therapist Alan Downs describes this delicious but toxic cocktail of anger and rejection in his book, The Velvet Rage.
Today, puppeteer, massage therapist, and internal family systems practitioner Mark Saltzman joins us to kick off our series on Velvet Rage, Alan Downs' seminal book for overcoming the pain of growing up gay in a straight man's world, and what everyone needs to understand about the gay experience. Listen as we talk about RuPaul's Inner Saboteur,
how queer communities often lash out against each other,
steps you can take to navigate your Velvet Rage,
and our secret struggles handling the guests of this show. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Feast of Fun is made possible because of the support of fierce, fabulous people like you. Become a member and listen to 14 years of amazing podcasts at feastoffun.com/plus. Or put a tip in our tip jar and make a one-time donation at feastoffun.com/donate. Thank you for your support. That's okay. If you want to be a star, you're going to go through a little bit of pain.
Right.
Okay, folks, our guest today is puppeteer, massage therapist, and internal family systems practitioner Mark Saltzman, who credits Alan Downs' book, Velvet Rage, with opening new horizons in his life.
Yeah.
Welcome to Feast of Fun.
I am honored. I've been listening to you boys for a long time, like right from the beginning.
From all the way to 2005.
Yeah.
Before even iTunes had a podcast directory.
Exactly.
And in all these years that we've done this podcast, this book, Velvet Rage, pops up again and again and again like this recurring meme that
like herpes.
Well, it's this idea that this book by this therapist in California, he saw gay men struggling with mental health issues, Alan Downs, and he decided, in reflecting on the AIDS crisis was about sort of looking at our bodies and our health of our physical beings, and now he turns around and says, you know, let's talk about our mental well-being. RuPaul is a huge fan of it. Peaches Christ.
She's the one that turned, she's like, you guys, we said something to her. She's like, ooh, Velvet Rage. And she's like, you guys need to read that book.
And Victoria Lamar, one of the earliest drag queens on the show, she was a big fan of it.
And,
you know, Velvet Rage is an interesting book because it's a self-help book that chronicles the emotional, the mental journey of a queer person living in this world, and they don't quite fit in.
Yeah, and I think he wrote more of it for himself. He was helping all these people with his psychology degree, but then he started noticing these patterns, and then he started noticing in himself. Mm-hmm. So as he was going through his journey, this book started to come out of him, is what he says,
What was the big pattern that, like, what was the thing that he was seeing over and over again? Just angry? Because you think Velvet Rage is like, it's a bunch of screaming queens, right?
Yeah. Well, do you know, we've all said this about someone. Oh, yeah, she's gay. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about,
Mary.
Yeah, oh, Mary, right. And then have you ever confronted one of those people? Hey, you know you're gay, right? You know, and you've known the people who have done this. And that person got angry.
Oh, yeah.
Really angry. That's the rage. Mm. We all know he's a big queer and we love him. And we were all that person once. But when someone touched that button, that anger popped out. Or the one quick thing we've said in the bar, oh, you're going to wear that again? And that boy just snaps. Mm-hmm. That's the rage.
Before we get
into Velvet Rage, let's talk a little bit about your background, Mark.
Yay.
Salzman, not Mark Felian.
Oh, is he ever going to be confused, aren't we?
Which is
your
last name.
My background.
You are well known as a puppeteer, and you've worked with a really impressive... your resume in theater is quite astounding. You actually know and have worked with Martian Delellas.
Oh, yeah.
Who fans of the show know. But I'm looking here. You were involved with the Disney's Bear and the Big Blue House.
Bear and the Big Blue House, yeah.
Jim Henson's Sesame Street Live.
Aww. Yeah, Sesame Street Live and then Henson's Bear and the Big Blue House. It was a company called V Corp out of Minnesota. Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I toured with them for 3 years.
What did you do exactly with them? Is it you were like a guy in a suit, or I mean?
I did a little bit with Sesame Street where I wore some suits.
What were you playing?
I was Snuffy's butt for.
You're the guy who was in the butt of Snuffleupagus.
Yeah, I was Snuffy's butt because I was at the end of another show, and I needed to kind of lock in a gig, and they brought me on to Sesame Street, so I kind of got the gig there. Got to do some of the stuff there. And then Bear started shortly after. We went into rehearsals for that. So I played Hugh Mann, the father of two kids and mom, dad, two kids. And we go into the woods and we meet Bear. And so they brought a human element into the puppetry mm-hmm. portion. Do you guys remember that show at all?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
But it was kind of like a spinoff to Sesame Street. Cause they were, at that time period, Children's Television Workshop that produces Sesame Street. You can listen to our podcast, mm-hmm. called Street Gang, where we talked a lot about it. They were very anxious about the success of Barney.
Yeah.
And they felt that Barney was going to bankrupt them and destroy the future of Sesame Street. So that's part of the reason they created Elmo and the Bear and the Big Blue House.
Right. So Sesame Street Live, they would take the live versions around the country. And it started with Sesame Street on Ice. And then they had these live stage shows. So mm-hmm.
Bear. And at that time period, it was like everything was on ice.
On ice, yeah.
Yeah.
And they mixed them into the stages.
Planet of the Apes on ice.
To arenas. Mm-hmm. And Bear toured. We toured Europe and Puerto Rico, all over the United States. And
so when did you become Snuffleupagus?
When someone got sick. Oh, really? How fast can you learn this choreography? I'm like, all right, step, kick, kick.
Are you standing or are you bent
over? You're standing and you're bent forward and unsnuffy and you're kind of hanging on to the costume inside, but
you're dependent on the person in front of you to not fall on your face.
You're watching their feet in front of them, so yeah, you just kind of follow.
You know the psychological significance of Snuffleupagus, right?
It was Big Bird's imaginary friend, and they actually, but that was scaring kids at one time. Right?
Psychologists and therapists were like scolding Sesame Street, saying, "You got to stop with this.
This is not healthy for kids' mind because kids want to be believed."
Exactly.
You know, if you're doing this kind of thing, you're making these kids think they're like, "Oh, there might really be a Santa Claus."
Exactly.
Well, and the idea. I remember very clearly when. Episode of Sesame Street, they made Snuffleupagus real. They finally, because everybody on Sesame Street thought he was an urban legend,
and they got to meet him.
And they finally got to meet him, and it's like Big Bird was like, "See, I told you, assholes." They pulled out an egg and smashed it on Maria's head. Right. That really didn't happen, but they did reveal that Snuffleupagus was real in one episode, and now he's part of the canon of that.
So, as this actor performer, I fell in love with these puppeteers who hid. They would hide and bring an object to life, and that's where I really became fascinated with puppetry. And then when I met Martian at the Eugene O'Neill Theater, watching these storytellers, tell these beautiful stories with objects was fascinating as well.
And we're talking here like this is in the late 90s, early 2000s, or?
Bear was 2001, 2003. Is when I did that.
When I was going to grad school, there was one performer that I went to school with for performance art, and she said, "Puppets! Everybody's doing puppets! I'm sick of stupid puppets!" Why were people so into puppets at that time period?
You know, they've been around forever. Remember? Yeah. Do you remember Captain Kangaroo?
Sure.
Yeah, that was the one that had me fascinated with puppets, was Moose and the stupid ping pong balls. But now I watch
it. Fran and Ollie?
For Kuka. Yeah. And he, Burl Tellstrom, I think that's his name. Mm-hmm. Forgive me if I said that wrong. he ended up in Saugatuck, Michigan.
Oh.
And Saugatuck is having the first Kukulcan Festival this summer, and they're bringing more puppetry back to Saugatuck because it had a he retired there.
Sure.
But he had, and I can't remember the name of the gentleman who helped him as a kid, and he's like, you cannot be gay and be a puppeteer. You cannot be gay and work with kids. So he lived in this very gay town with people who didn't give a crap, and he hid his who he truly was, because he couldn't be a puppeteer and be gay. And this is what, this leads right to the Velvet Rage.
Are you talking about Kevin Clash and Elmo, or?
No.
Okay.
The guy, Burr Tillstrom, sure, who created Kukla, Fran, and Ollie.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was a gay man. He was a gay man.
Okay.
And he went around to schools. He had that, the Kukla show, and, he would forcibly hide his, you know, his self.
What was Kukla anyway?
It was a snake.
It was a snake?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Fran and Ollie.
They were people.
Sure. The height of performance art in the mid-90s, when people were sort of turning to art as a way to galvanize people to deal with the height of the AIDS crisis, there became a really interest in Eastern culture. So a lot of dance artists were doing buto, which is a Japanese kind of ghost-like dancing. And a lot of sculptors and performance artists were interested in bunraku puppets. And that that whole scene in New York City culminated with Disney buying the New Amsterdam Theater and turning it to one of the largest theaters in New York. And they hired one of the world-class puppeteers who was doing a lot of Shakespearean plays, Julie Taymor.
Yeah.
And they did this spectacle. Disney got into Broadway because of puppets.
Right.
And they wanted to show off the New Amsterdam Theater and all it could do. And so when I first saw The Lion King, it was just like, it was an emotional moment because I was presented with this dazzling future and past of every theatrical expression all at the same time in the opening number of Circle of Life.
Right.
And you just had so much pageantry and visual spectacle and, you know, this grandiose African savanna and these little insects all represented beautifully in this show.
And the emotion that just pours out of people when they watch the show. So I built all those puppets for a theater over in Oak Park, Bravo Theater.
You did kind of a Lion King Jr. or something?
Lion King Jr.
What exactly does that mean?
So
it was like a low budget version?
There's still lots of money. MTI, Music Theater International, they license the main show, cut it down, they take some of the songs out, and they, you know, make it a little easier for junior schools or high schools to do these programs. And my friend Tina Reynolds, she has started this program 15 years ago. And we've always wanted to do Lion King, and we got the nod from MTI to go ahead, and we've piloted a few shows. We actually are piloting one right now that I can't even say the name of, because
so you're working like on a bunch
hard
of
to
things.
Pronounce or
it's hard to pronounce. Oh. It's one you know, but I can nod. No, it's a licensing thing where we can't even advertise we're doing it, but we're really lucky in Oak Park to be able to do some of these shows, and we did James and the Giant Peach. And I built the first puppets for that, and then we went to Lion King. I turned Ursula into a puppet.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Fun.
So your drag is off the hook.
Yeah, it's fun. I got an Ursula costume that you'll...
Can I
you'll...
borrow it?
Sure.
So in all this, you get involved in massage therapy.
I was a performer and I kept getting hurt, you know, and then I would go see these physiotherapists and physical therapists and massage therapists, and they'd work on my twisted ankle or my bad back, and I became fascinated how these people could get me back to work quickly. So when I would, it kind of was in the back of my mind. So it was in 92 I went to massage school the first time, and I did 6 months, and then I got another gig. I got the 50th year anniversary of Oklahoma, and I was dancing Curly. So I dropped out of school and I did that show. And I've always wanted to go back, and in 2008, I finally did, and I went to Bastyr University in Seattle, Washington, kind of a naturopathic school, and the satellite program was with Bellevue Massage School. So they start everybody as a massage therapist, and then you can go into be a naturopath or a doula. Mm-hmm. And so
an doula is for people who don't know what that term
is. A doula
means.
Is for, you know, someone who helps have babies. They guide the mother. Through
like a midwife.
Child. Yeah, but a little different, very naturopathic way.
And Mark has a thing with his elbow. I don't know if you want to bring it up.
Yeah. So I have this yeah. passion about helping, learning about my body.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm like, gosh, why don't people know how to sit? Why do we do these things? you just adjusted your body. Yeah. Right. But
I'm
there's
leaning into the microphone here.
Yeah. Yeah. We all do it. But when you've been to the gym, look at these bodies. You've been to the gym how many times?
I just got out of the gym.
You just got out of the gym. Thousands of times.
Yeah.
And I know the viewers won't be able to see this, but we're going to do it. So
my ripped, Felsto, muscular.
Stand up.
Oh, you want me to stand up right now?
No, just stand up. Right.
But I'm covered in cables.
I know. Do your best. Okay. Do your best.
I'm standing up.
Okay. All right. Did you see his posture as he did that? Kind of record this. Mm. Now sit back down.
Yeah.
All right. Now, if
you're making me work,
do you see him, how he tipped forward?
Yeah.
He tipped forward.
Is that bad? Is that not good?
Would you do that if you had weight on your back?
No.
No. So when we sit in a chair,
sure,
we do this thing where we bend and we push off the chair or push off the arms. Mm-hmm. But we go to the gym and we do the proper squat. Why aren't we doing that all day long?
Okay.
Right. So, and then slowly our bodies start to break down. So that became very interesting to me, and I love teaching clients.
It's hard for old people to get out of chairs.
Yeah, because if you keep doing that, your glutes are going to disappear when you're 70 or 80 because they're just going to atrophy because you used all your knees to stand up. You didn't use your hips.
You're just full of all kinds of information.
I love
it. So your passion sort of, and your life sort of mirrors the growth or the liberation of gay men and queer people.
Yeah.
In the sense that we were, you know, in the 90s, we were thinking about our bodies. And we were trying to sort of heal ourselves in that sense. And now we're sort of moving more into our mental space.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to be noticed. So what's the best way to do that? Get into theater. You know, I wanted validation. I wanted people. And how do you get that? People clap for you.
Sure.
So
I live for the applause.
Absolutely. We all do. It was very validating. But then I'd go home and I'd be like, poor me again.
Well, a friend of mine in the Radical Fairies, Kulov, said one time that all performers have the post partum depression after a show ends.
Yeah, yeah.
Or even at every single night, like there's this emptiness, there's a sadness.
Yes, right. And what is that?
And I'm just like, I'm just tired. I want to sleep. You know, I put a lot of my time and energy and I'm like,
it might be like a chemical reaction because you have
absolutely.
All those, you know, you have a lot of hormones and stuff running through your body at
endorphins,
yeah. But the, yeah. You know, the stress hormones running through you. And so you're finally able to just kind of like, it's done.
And but there's this drop, there is an emptiness there. And if you start looking at that empty, and I had a huge emptiness. And so when I was with my ex-partner for 8.5 years and when that fell apart, it all came rushing back. All the childhood. I did have some suicidal.
When you broke up with him.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had suicidal thoughts as a kid. You know, and it was mostly from going to church, listening to it was 11 years old, listening to the pastor spout Ephesians at me. You know, all gays are going to hell.
And that what kind of religion was this?
It was a non-denominational Christian kind of church.
These Unitarians were hating on the gays?
Yeah.
I thought Jesus was a metaphor for anal sex.
There's more non-denominationals than universalists. There's a bunch of
I don't know anything about these things.
Yeah.
But
it was a little town in Lake George, Michigan. So.
Okay.
But that stuck with me, and it gave me an element of shame why am I like this? You know, and I was always praying, like, I need this to go away. I need this to go away. I was trying to pray the gay away. I even went to Exodus. Do you remember Exodus?
I've heard of Exodus. Yeah.
I did a few sessions of that and had some really good sex after those meetings.
Did you really?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you tell us about these meetings. So you show up at a meeting.
It's basically gay AA where you go and you sit around and there's these two very feminine men who would just, you know, they would speak about the Bible. They would speak about how you could remove this and you were choosing to be gay. And it felt like such bullshit. And then when we were standing around talking, I was getting hit on and I was like, what's going on here?
Were these guys just using it as a place to find fresh meat?
I think so. It was great though. He was hot.
Well, all right.
I wonder what happened to him.
I have to confess, one time I went to a sex addicts meeting to see if I could pick up somebody.
Nice.
And I was like, these guys are all a bunch of wet blankets. But part of it is like, you know, I think for a lot of LGBTQ people, you know, we are sort of misfits. We're
right. We don't fit in.
Strangers in a strange land. We right. we come from a different mindset and perspective, and you know, in throughout our liberation, there's been different attempts to sort of like explain or understand that idea that we're not. We're a square peg in a round hole world.
Right.
And sort of like a gay liberation writer for the Mattachine Society, Harry Hay, wrote in his book Radically Gay, he talked about sort of the queer person, the gay man, as a shaman figure that we sort of exist in this world to heal, to teach, to guide. And that's why our attraction to theater is. Mm-hmm. Alan Downs, in his book, he kind of rejects this idea. He says that our interest in being these jack-of-all-trades, these shamans, these showboaters, these really charming hosts, some of us don't necessarily attracted to that, but a lot of us are, is because we have a phantom menace, a ghost that influences us that we can't taste, see, touch, or smell, but is there from our birth to the grave, and that is shame.
Yes, shame. That's the root of, and it resonated with me fully. I was in an element of ashamed of who I was. And I always felt like I did not fit in. So when I opened this book and I was like, holy crap, it just came flooding. And just want to preface this is a hard book. When people pick this up, be ready to read it and be ready to feel some stuff. And if you need more help, if you need to talk to a psychiatrist first before you dive into this, because it will bring up some stuff. I've given this book to friends that I thought it would really help them. They read 10 or 12 pages, they put it down, and they have not spoke to me again. It's a tough read.
Maybe there's another, you know, last night at Peaches Christ show, you were acting out.
Oh, totally.
So, sorry, you know, Peaches. Maybe there's other reasons why they're not talking to you or anything.
Maybe.
It's just like, is it the book? No, they're like, because you were. But
seriously, though, you know, for somebody that are not necessarily prepared to deal with a lot of this stuff, because, you know, it kind of hits a lot of gay men at the core.
It does. It does. And I mean, the thing that got me with this book most of all, I saw a little bit of myself, mm-hmm. and then I got a little bit farther. I was like, well, that's not really me. Mm-hmm. But wait a minute. That's a lot of my friends. Mm. There's those people in your life that they did that thing, and you're like, okay, bye, girl. I'm not talking to you again.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you just cut them out of your life. Mm-hmm. After I read this book, I was like, oh, she's stage two. Well, so am I. So mm-hmm. I get you. Empathy is the best thing. I know how you feel. You know, knowing where somebody is and knowing that I was there as well, and I can have some more compassion for that person.
That's what I kind of found very interesting about it. It's like, oh, I recognize this in myself, but boy, do you recognize other people in your community from this, you know? And the listeners who read this book will probably recognize, like, oh, that's totally Marker Fauster right there.
you know,
the people that you know. It's the people that you know and the people that you hang out with. We all have that kind of that thing, and I think that now that I've started reading the book, there's it changes the way you act a little bit, because you're like, oh, I have to be a little more careful about this kind of thing, and am I acting out because of this? What RuPaul might call your inner saboteur.
Your saboteur. And the big thing is to not make your, we're all in our space. It's a journey for everyone. You're where you are in this moment. Just be there.
But I would say, like, you know, my friend Kirthy, who she's a producer for Teen Mom, and Mark and I do a web series called Cooking with Drag Queens, mm-hmm. starring soon on YouTube.com/feast of fun. And we run into a lot of bumps in the road in managing a lot of our guests that are on the podcast or the web series. And part of that is just dealing with a lot of the heightened emotions, the anger, the frustration,
the rage.
You give mm-hmm. somebody a compliment and they're like, they're looking for that one little sliver that, you know, you give them a compliment, but it's really secretly a backhanded insult.
Right.
And so my friend Kirthy said to me, he's like, you've really chosen a really difficult path for yourself, wanting to make content about drag queens and LGBTQ people, because your community struggles a lot. And here you are trying. You're not a therapist. Mm-hmm. It's you and your husband. And you're creating all this work that analyzes and looks at their mental well-being and their mental space. You're telling their life story.
Right.
And this is somebody who deals with Sarah Palin's daughter You know, this is somebody who deals with Teen Mom on MTV. Which you guys have watched the show. You know, she Kirthy is somebody who, like, she is managing some people on the verge of a nervous breakdown, and she says that we're brave.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you're describing is the middle of his book there, that aspect of validation, of seeking it. And then when you get a perceived notion of not being validated, and that's what happens to us mostly as gay men, there'll be just that one little slight that we'll hear at the bar or at the party. And that throws you into this, to the rage aspect. And the rage can be, it's not just screaming and throwing everything. It could be something as standing up and walking out or never talking to you again. So that the rage has levels.
Because you never know what's going to set somebody off. You can you can make fun of their hair. You can make fun of their eyes. But goddamn, if you say something about their ass, they're going to freak out.
Right, and then you
just never know what's going to happen.
Exactly.
But I think that's also kind of true of a lot of different people. You know, it's not something that's just typical of just gay men.
Right.
It's of a lot. I remember reading the book, like, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. They were talking about one person. They would set all these kinds of things to this person. They were in a concentration camp. But then they said something about, like, how their shit stinks. And the person ends up, like, throwing themselves up against an electrical fence because they were, like, so insulted by it.
In
Alan Down's book, Velvet Rage, he talks about shame as invisible.
Yeah.
If it's invisible and we can't, you know, measure it or taste it or see it, like, how do we even describe it? How do you know what shame is?
Well, I would say, like, guilt is, I did something wrong. I'm sorry, Fausto, I did something wrong. Shame is, I am wrong. I don't feel guilty because I'm gay. But I felt wrong because I was gay for a long time.
You wanted to give your mother, like, a traditional family with kids, and it's like, as a gay person, as an artist, you're going to live a life that's not aligned to her expectations for you.
The society norms, they're all in our face. And as men, we're told, don't be a pussy, man up, you know, all that shit. And we feel like we just don't fit in. You knew you were different when you were quite young, right? I think all of us knew that we were special or something was off. Or we thought it was. And
I thought everybody else was like me.
Yeah. I didn't. You know, we had this conversation like a couple of weeks ago. I said, I didn't fit into some kind of situation. I said, but it doesn't matter because it's like I've always felt like no matter where I have been, I've never fit in.
And so many gays have felt that same thing. Like, I don't care how. I mean, I go to these leather conventions with all this stuff on and I'm all daddied up. And I, you know, and you'll get that wave of shame where it feels like, okay, you know, no one's talking to me, and should I go talk to that? And that's
it feels performative. It doesn't feel authentic for you. It feels like a costume.
Sometimes, yeah. Well, then everything's drag, right?
Sure, you're born naked. That's what I told RuPaul. I was born naked, and still in drag. You know. So, in terms of shame, maybe we can look at like its effect or what it makes us do. So he lists five things. He talks about hiding. Avoiding people who trigger that shame in us.
Oh, yeah.
So if you're hooked up with a guy and you're like at a club, you're like, you're not going to talk to that guy.
No, it's more so that the people who are seriously closeted, like when I was very in the closet, I was in the military right after high school. And if I saw someone who was doing something that was slightly gay, I avoided that person like the plague. I did not want to associate with anybody who was feminine, you know, and then what did you do? You called them faggot. You know, there were so many of us that bullied other gay people that were.
It made you feel better. And I still notice that in a lot of people who have a lot of unresolved emotional issues. With RuPaul saying, if you can't love yourself, how the hell are you going to love somebody else? And I thought about Perez Hilton, the Latino blogger who's always sort of fighting with people.
Right.
If you hate yourself, it's really easy to hate somebody else.
Totally. Mm-hmm. And who's RuPaul talking to when she says that?
He's talking about herself.
Right. She is talking to herself.
She's trying
to
convince her. Namarangi Kyo means keep it together, girl, because shit is going down.
Right. And we don't do that at first. It takes a while to get to that point to really love yourself because we're always trying to. We put on the costume. We put on the drag. We put on a persona when we go out all the time. And that is an aspect of shame.
We can see shame by it asking us to hide who we really are.
Right.
Shame also asks us to lie.
Totally. How many people pretend they're not gay and they stay in the closet? They get married. They have kids. You know, and that's wonderful. We all know those people they've hidden their lives. They went that route. They have wonderful children. But how much difficulty of hiding who they truly wanted to be would have been in their physical body? And
did you eat that slice of cake? No, I didn't. Well, I was saving it for us later. I was like, nope, I didn't eat it. You must have eaten it. And then, you know, a lot of young people like to use the term gaslighting.
Mm. Do they use it properly, though?
I don't think so. Yeah. But the gaslighting means like you're manipulating somebody else into questioning their own sanity.
Yes.
In order to allow you to get away with bad behavior.
Right.
And then in some ways, that's, you know, also what Alan talks about is compartmentalizing your life.
Your shame, yeah.
You're like the expression, butch in the streets, queen in the sheets.
Yep.
Or as Katya says, Dostoevsky in the streets.
So, Lenin in the sheets.
Lenin in the sheets. You know, and part of this idea is that, like, in your, you know, and that we as queer people, we have this idea that we've come out of the closet, we've gone to therapy, we think we're beyond it, we think we're above it all.
Right.
You know, I'm a drag queen touring around the world, I got fans, you know. And he says, like, this is not necessarily something that you ever can overcome.
Right.
So why would we even bother reading this book?
How do you get rid of the rage?
Well, this was just the beginning of my process to really understand who this. This led me to Michael Singer.
Who's that?
Michael Singer and this is another big Oprah book. It was The Untethered Soul and The Surrender Experiment. And these were just pieces of the puzzle for me that really helped me understand who I was and why I did. Why did I hide for so long? Why did I pretend I wasn't gay when I knew I was? And why did I try to pretend so much? Why did I need that validation so much for every show? And even when I put the leather on again, like last night, it's validating. It feels good. So I know I'm still.
You look cute in it.
I did.
You look good. You're right. A hot daddy.
But then there's that aspect of I am more confident and self-loving than I've ever been. Like, I don't give a shit what people say anymore to me. Whatever they want to do, that's fine. But, you know, I love me. And it's really hard to get to that place. And everybody needs to find their tool. Like, this book may not help people. Like I said, I've given it to many people who have put it down.
Mm-hmm.
And
they weren't ready for it yet.
Or they just don't agree with it. Mm-hmm. And, like, nowadays, there's these young kids who have seen two men like you in a loving relationship. I never saw that as a kid. So
when we first started podcasting and you were among, you know, one of our first listeners, we'd get emails from people that say, you know, you're the first gay person who I knew for 100% fact was gay that I've heard speak.
Right.
You know, right. They never or like they just never thought in their wildest dreams that they would listen to a computer, a program coming through their computer because this is before iPods not before iPods, but before it was supported in the iTunes store.
Yeah.
And so they were just, you know, they were shocked that this even was happening.
Right. And it felt like there's my people. I do fit in somewhere. But then
I remember the first time that I saw like Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, the original with the good cast, Tad Allen. Mm-hmm. You know, because part of it is like the original Queer Eye for the Straight Guy was built on knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of some of the cast, I think, you know, certainly like Tad Allen, it was a fountain of knowledge and wisdom that grounded that show in a really significant way for me. And it became sort of like we heal ourselves by helping others to heal.
Mm.
And I was very moved by the series because it's something that I wanted to manifest in the world.
Well, you have.
With the rebooting of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, I feel like in some ways it's regressive. And Alan talks about this in his book, is Velvet Rage, is that we're sort of become sort of what Spike Lee calls the magic Negro in film, where the supporting actor to someone else's life, and we're using our otherness and as a way to help the cisgendered heterosexual person heal.
Sure.
And we never, our dreams, our aspirations, our passions are never met, are never even addressed or never even considered.
Yeah. It's a small piece of the puzzle of trying to figure out who you are. And there lies in the problem. It, you know, just like in a 12-step program, people who don't go to programs who don't need them. If it's not a problem, it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
There's some of my one friend who had a good beef and he had a great argument for the book. he doesn't feel shame. He doesn't feel like going to the gym and working out. And, but he has a confidence that he somehow got from his parents quite early. So he didn't feel a lot of the shame that I felt. Mm. He didn't have to hide as a gay person as very young.
He's never binged eat or at all. Come on.
Yeah. This boy's beautiful, but there was a few things that doesn't,
he's never tried to avoid somebody.
He doesn't resonate with
but
all
does
of
he,
it.
Does he recognize though that he sees it a lot in other people though?
He understands the shame aspect. He understands parts of it, but there's some things in here that, you know, it's not going to resonate with a 21-year-old as much as it's going to be with a 51-year-old.
Sure.
Yeah. So that's,
because they're living in a different time now.
Totally.
So this is something you'd say it's probably like people like 35 and above, 30 and above.
Or, right. Right.
I don't know. I see some of this behavior in some young people though. That's
it is there. Especially this day and age. I'm holding the Scruff app right now, everybody. Mm-hmm. And if you scroll through these pictures and you'll see how someone takes a picture of themselves. Mm-hmm. I'm really noticing this. There are the people who hold the camera to the mirror and look in the camera, right?
Yeah.
Then there's the people who hold the camera and look in the mirror. Mm-hmm. Or then there's the people that just take the picture to themselves.
Yeah.
Right?
Those are three different kinds of people.
Three different. Well, what are they seeing when they do that?
I want to. Yeah, this is
what
good.
Are they
this,
yeah. No, I'm working on this one. This is, okay. This is a process I'm working on right now to see.
So you don't know what it is yet.
Oh, I think I do.
What is it?
Why are we doing it? Why do you put the drag on last night? Why did I put the leather on? First of all, it feels good for me. I love doing it. But then there is this aspect of validation. People went, oh, wow, he's hot. You know? And I mean, we're trying to build our body up or have the nice haircut to get noticed. Mm-hmm. Like we do it all the time. We seek. But if you're doing it because you absolutely need that validation, then maybe it's a little bit of a problem. Maybe you should look into why are you doing it. If you're just doing it to take a picture, then fine. It's not a problem. Mm-hmm. But if someone... you talk to them for a second and then they block you and they get all angry. There's the rage.
Oh yeah. Well, even if you look on Scruff, because on Grindr, you don't get much of a, you can't read much of a profile,
right.
But if you read through some of these profiles, some of these people are hardcore ragers.
Right.
It's
totally.
Like they're going to yell at you about everything that's happening in their life, everything they hate about gay culture.
If you say this, I'm blocking you.
And all this sort of stuff. And I'm just kind of like, I'm of the school of, tell me what you do want. Tell me what you do like.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And also, don't give me too much information. Let me live my fantasy, as the girls say.
Yeah, don't show me that right away, please.
There was a whole industry for a while of blog articles and posts and movements, in some ways shaming gay men for telling them or trying to control or castigate them of what they were interested in sexually or how they behaved on these hookup apps.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I felt that it was very misguided.
It was about racism. It was about people being like, no fats, no femmes, no Asians,
Or fetishizing a color or race.
But in some ways, like, I felt like it was really misguided because it was more than eager to sort of look at how we failed each other. And not really talking too much about solutions. It was all about, and I'm like, look, these apps can, if you're racist on your app and your profile, the app company can block you.
Right.
These app companies are more interested in blocking drag queens who are posting flyers as their fake profile pics than they are interested in anybody posting anything problematic or harmful.
And why don't they just let those girls advertise and pay a little money?
Exactly.
Yeah, make some money.
So all this discussion about, like, you know, fighting racism, in my opinion, was very superficial because they could have just said, well, this is the behavior we don't want to see in our user base, just block them.
Right.
Take it someplace else, you know?
But how is the Chinese company going to get all your information and sell it to the government so that when they take over, they know exactly who you are, where you live, and what your HIV status is?
Yeah, they already took over.
And part of that is, it's like, we really relish quite a bit in fighting with each other, you know? And right now here in Chicago, you know, like, we drag queens in Chicago have a reputation for being, like, mean girls, but Peaches Cry Show was
the show last night, even though they made a parody of it, but it's really true. And I felt
personally attacked by quite a few drag queens in that audience, you know?
Sure.
So this past year has been a roller coaster ride for me. And, you know, I've thankfully had an amazing support community to help me get through, you know, our car breaking down to dealing with cancer, you know, our computer breaking down. It was like just so many things were just falling apart. And some of these people in our community were ridiculing me and making fun of me. And to me, it was like I felt so sorry for them because I was like, this is a great gift for me because I know that I don't have to deal with you anymore.
Right. Well, and
I can forgive you, but you know, I can also distance myself from you.
And that's the thing that with most gay men, you give us one little bit of bad validation and I will attack you. You know, how many times have you been attacked by somebody and you just, whoa, wait a minute. What? I didn't, all I said was hi. And they're just quick to snap.
Mm-hmm. Alan Downs. I keep wanting to call him Hugh Downs.
Different guy.
This is 2020.
2020. Mm-hmm. He talks about emotions being like a drug.
Yeah.
In the same way that we're addicted to alcohol, we get addicted to rage, which is, you know, everybody talks about rageaholics. Mm-hmm. But what Alan talks about is that anger can actually be addictive because it narrows our thinking and reinforces your own perceptions and views around the world.
Yeah.
You're never questioning. But so when you send that angry email or you call out somebody on social media or you know, do something that is expressed in anger, right after that step is regret.
Yeah. Or shame. Yeah, it's the aspect of, like, say you were up for a promotion and you've been working really hard, but then you didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of gay men have went, well, I didn't get it because I was gay. You know,
I feel that way.
Right.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And it might be true. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And again, the element of rage is different from full on screaming, throwing things, slamming the door, running out of the house. Or as my ex, hopefully he's listening to this, smashed a bag of or the plastic thing of mayonnaise. He just slammed it down and it went flying everywhere.
Oh, there was a man. It up.
Not me. Hell no. I just walked out of the house. But that aspect of rage that the moment was so trivial.
Mm.
And he had built up this story of what was happening that it snapped out of him. And later on, he said, I have no idea why I did that.
And had you read the book by that point in time?
I have not. I have not. Yeah. But when I got to that, it was like,
it really is. You know, I think back about some of my earlier relationships with men and just the, it was definitely kind of like having that rage, especially during the coming out process, because your brain is like, I want to be out. I want to be this thing. But I've also been so ashamed for so long. What am I going to do? And so it's easy to really just to snap and cut people off like that. Right.
So what you just said is basically the whole book, the first two parts of the book. Mm-hmm. The last part is trying to really understand it and lead a more authentic life.
Mm. And so it's not the idea of like getting rid of it, sort of like Spock's brother in Star Trek, The Final Frontier. Yeah. It's about navigating it.
Yes. And everybody does it a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
And like my friend who didn't resonate with, he recognized there's parts of it, but you know, he has a solid base of something else that he learned from his parents, from his friends, from someone that filled the gaps for this was exactly what I needed to read at the time I read it. And it brought up all the emotions. A lot of us were suicidal as kids. I was definitely one of those persons. And I went to some therapists. I went to some clergy to really work on it. And I worked on it. I figured it out. I said, okay, this is in me, but I don't want this to happen.
Mm.
After my breakup, all those feelings came rushing back. And I went, what the heck? Why is this back again? And as I read that book, it kind of clicked. I was like, oh. So it gave me a little bit more information. Then I found the next tool, the next book, the next seminar. And it just led me to this place where I want to be my true authentic self.
Mm.
I want to get up at Peaches Christ Show and just be me and not give a shit. You know, yeah, it wasn't my show, but
I was having fun. Tell the audience what happened.
I was having fun.
Let's talk about this here. So, you know, so we went to see Peaches Christ Mean Gays. We're all in the front.
Fabulous show.
Normally, anytime we see, you know, when Coco Peru famously, like, I think part of it is like for people who are used to seeing drag shows, there's a level of interaction that doesn't occur in a theatrical performance. in a traditional theatrical.
So I was thinking
if you were
would.
Talking during Lion King, they would kick you out.
Sure. Or on your phone.
Or on your phone.
Right.
And your behavior or your friend's behavior, or somebody in your area was disruptive to the point that the performers on the stage felt very unnerved by it.
Yeah, those two were next to me. They were. I don't know what they were chatting about. I kept nudging them, but
so it wasn't you.
So no, you weren't the one that was super loud.
No. I was a little loud.
I thought it was you. I was like, oh, please not be Mark Saltzman.
Well, the one thing I'm always
good
at.
They were sitting next to you.
Tip your drag queens. That sure. stuff doesn't sparkle for free, right? Does Muffy always say that? Is that one of
tip them in the meet and greet after the show?
Right, but I've always the shows that I've been to. You know, you give those girls some money, and they kept eyeing me. So I'm like, here's $20. So just give them some money. That was probably the rudest thing
didn't
I did.
She see?
I
walked
she tear it in half and handed it.
What did she? She gave a dollar. She's like, if I give you this dollar, will you finally shut up?
To Willem?
To you?
Willem said that to. I don't think it was the other guy.
Said that to you.
I think it was to the other guy.
To the other guy. Oh, and part of it was like, you know, I think he kind of looked like you. So it was like, it was hard to tell. Like some guy in leather, you know?
Yeah, we were all in leather.
And so it was, you know, part of it is like, you know, that clone. I think it was the 70s clone look, right? It don't look.
That looked the same.
Everybody looks the same. Right. Mustache, leather, hat, and all this stuff. And so, you know, part of it is like they were angry at you guys. You guys were trying to like connect with them, and it becomes this vicious feedback loop.
Yeah.
Where you're like, no, I really, you know, I got into a fight with a drag queen one time because she was being shady with me. And I just was trying to align with her. And I just said the same thing back to her. And she was furious. And I was so devastated by that I kept on trying to apologize, and she's just like, you're just digging your hole deeper.
Right. And that's okay. We're going right back to the book now.
Yeah.
So when we do that slight validation, when we do not give the validation to that person, that slight sparks the rage.
Mm.
And the rage is everybody has a different level, and it can be sometimes so simple.
Mm.
Here are some things that Mark and I have sort of run across in talking to a lot of LGBTQ people.
Do you have a list?
Yes.
I see him looking at his computer. I'm like, uh-oh.
That's a spreadsheet. It's not a list.
What advice, because I'm curious to hear about you, what advice do you give people, and most recently, like, drag queens, you know, here in town, they're fighting with each other. They're literally, they fight with each other in order to get the bar to kick them out so they can take their job. Wow. And the bar stupidly do that, play into that. With Murray and Peter and these drag queens.
Oh, have you been following that drama with the Murray and Peter Present?
I have not.
So, Monet
really
Exchange.
Quickly.
Really yeah. quickly.
Who is Murray and Peter?
They are, I guess, a production company, and they do like the Haters Roast or something, or they do Christmas with the drag queens, which I hear is absolutely terrible.
Mm.
And so they...
That's editorialization.
Well, I hear it's terrible.
We should go see it. For sure.
Listen, if they want to give me a free ticket, I'll go and review it. Because as a journalist, what was I going to say? Monet. Do these touring shows, and Monet Exchange said I'm dropping out because I'm going to go do a video with Madonna.
Yeah.
But she dropped out just hours before the show was supposed to start.
Wouldn't you? Well, if you had an opportunity,
she hightailed it out of the theater to get on a plane to be in Madonna's video.
She was in the middle of a show.
That was like up
but
to the last
it's
minute.
It's a group show, so it would have been missing one person out of how many?
Okay,
people?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, if there's eight queens, are they really going to miss Monet? I know she's, you know, a drag superstar and in the Hall of Fame, but, you know, I'm sure they could have squeezed by without her. And plus, it's Madonna, you know? The Queen Bee. So, of course, she's going to probably want to do it. Not, if I were them, I would have been like, you know what? This is your chance. Go. We expect you back, and you owe us one.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And just move on. But no, they were invalidated.
And they were
jealous.
They
took to Twitter.
Yeah.
And were invalidated. Yeah. And so now, because they felt invalidated, they went to Twitter. Now all the other drag queens are like piling on. And it's like Jackie Beat is one of them.
Trinity the Tuck Taylor.
A lot of them are just be like, don't don't work with these people. Bob the Drag Queens is like, we're starting a revolution. Fuck Peter and Murray. We're going to start producing our own shows, and we don't even need them anymore.
Wow.
I've always been like, own the means of production, Queens.
That's why we do this podcast, honey.
But is there an element that we enjoy that drama as gay people?
Well, it's fun because we've been watching this TV show and where that's built on the conflict between the contestants. And when the show ends, it's sort of like, you know, we still want to see that type of interaction with these people we've grown to love.
And our wonderful writers, all the gay writers out there, take these real life stories and turn them into these wonderful shows that we continue to go watch as Mean Girls last night. And it's
so what advice would you give to somebody in terms like Murray and Peter or these drag queen, like Mark and I, you know, I think we finally got to the point where we're just like, look, don't engage with these people. Ban, block, delete. And certainly, like on our YouTube channel, somebody's like coming after one of our guests or coming after us. You're not going to get a chance to post that on our page.
Well, I think my advice is you have to know yourself. Mm-hmm. And if someone says something to you and it gives you such a visceral response, why? When did you first have that response? When did you ever feel that the first time? And you kind of have to do that work. You have to go back and look at when were you first. When did you feel validation first, and when did you feel it like being ripped away from you? And look at that, and that's a journey. And everybody's journey is separate.
But in terms of engaging with that person who's out to harm you or to fight with you, it's best just to walk away from that, isn't it?
What I would do is just, I mean, if I had that level of fame, I don't look at comments. I mean, and if you do read them.
Don't do it before bedtime, I'll tell you that.
No,
yeah, Mark did that too the other day. I was like, oh, look at this. And then he's like, do not look at that before going to bed.
Right, because and then you think about that little voice in your head that just talks and talks and talks. Yeah. And I really wanted to learn how to meditate. And this last year, I've actually been able to, I'm up to about 25 minutes. And it changes every day depending on what I've got going on.
Don't you get bored?
You got a lot of free time to meditate for half an hour.
Well, I get up earlier. I wake up an hour early. I say I'm gonna use this hour right now to get ready for my day.
Yeah.
I will lie. It's always different, and I really look at that little voice in the head. What is it? What does it feel like? And just acknowledge it and taking and learning from different people of how to meditate. Mm-hmm. And that's been this next journey.
Hubris, the lack of desire to delegate or ask for help. Mm. We see this a lot.
Yeah.
And part of it is like, I am, you know, sometimes guilty of this too. And you are being a jack of all trades stems from this, helplessness, or, you know, we don't feel like we're going to get other people helping us create our vision. So we need to become the captain of a starship. We need to know how to build the engine, how to put the gas in the tank, how to fly the plane, how to speak the foreign language, and how to be diplomats, cook, chef, lover, everything.
Right. Because if we don't, we're going to be perceived as what? Weak.
Inadequate,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And what were we told as kids, or my age? I heard it many times. Man up. Don't be a pussy. You know?
And I noticed this with a lot of trans women are amazing at computer programming, being musicians, and putting on a cabaret show. Like, I'm thinking about like Calpurnia Adams.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
She's just has an amazing ability to do like 100 things that are just... Right. Super complicated and technical.
We want to do it all. We want to be the best at it. We want to have the biggest house, the nicest car, the hottest boyfriend. And that's right in the book. And that it, when you get into the
middle. To get the validation, right?
To get the validation.
Because otherwise you're a worthless piece of shit, right?
And then once you realize you just are, you're going, I don't care if I am or not. Then you're comfortable.
I don't need you. I can do bad all by myself.
But that aspect of hearing those words, man up and all of that, that's part of feeling like I don't fit in. Mm. And I have to prove to the world and to everyone around me that I am the best at this. Mm-hmm. Right? Why are my puppets, you know, 17 feet tall? Because it's got to stand out. Bigger is better, yeah.
Real fast, arrogance is kind of tied to hubris. Gossiping, the pleasure of speaking when other people are not present about
them. We're still talking about drag queens, right?
Hating on others. there's a pleasure in you know, Schadenfreude to seeing Murray and Peter struggle.
Sure.
Makes us feel good because we're like, well, it's good. It's not me.
That's one of the things I want to talk to you about this book, too, is Fausto pointed out to me and I started noticing it. And, you know, Jacqueline Suzanne was a famous author, right, from the 60s. And she said this one thing. And she's like, I like to write these books because, like, people, and it's a bestseller because it's about rich and wealthy people having these problems. And everyday normal people can be like, look, they've got it fucked up, too.
Right.
And when you read Velvet Rage, it's always like, Ben was the CEO of his company and he flew his private jets everywhere, but he was still unhappy. And then what's the, he collected Renoir paintings and he'd drive up to the mountaintop chalet and he was still unhappy. And right. It was just kind of like,
oh, it's like a Good Times episode. Yeah. He commits suicide at the end of it.
Yeah. Right. So it's like all these people that are really well off in their careers and it's still not there. And so, you know, for like a young kid who's just in college or for somebody who's like disadvantaged, it's like, can they relate to it? Or do you think that like, or is there a pleasure in seeing that like even the rich and powerful hate themselves as much as we do?
And the people that it doesn't resonate, if it's not a problem, unless mm-hmm. it's a problem.
Yeah.
So to have that much money, to have all that car, to have the fancy mm-hmm. paintings mm-hmm. and still be miserable, mm-hmm. that's a problem.
Yeah.
Then they need some type of...
But I'm just saying for somebody who's like down and out, maybe poor and broke, is right. this the same... Would they? Do you think that this book would still be helpful to them in that respect? When because you're looking at somebody that's just like... Why would I relate to these rich gays?
Well, money doesn't buy happiness, but right. you can lease it for a while.
Right. It makes things comfortable, but it doesn't make you happy.
Well, but I think Alan does himself a disservice in getting his message out there by focusing only on stories of the rich and powerful and famous and not really like you never hear about Tyrone and Pinky borrowed his truck and he was late on his truck. And, you know, he went to the burger joint. And, you know, it's always like. Just this, you know, they were vacationing at Provincetown. You know, it's always just a one cruise ship, yacht, chalet story after another. And I'm just like, it could be better.
I think he was writing it from his perspective because, mm-hmm. I mean, he was a big shot at Hewlett-Packard. His story at the end of it, he kind of summarizes his portion mm-hmm. of his life. And, sure. You have the second edition. And the first time he wrote it, he didn't talk about himself. And this time he's added his view. So he's coming from the aspect of he was a high-powered executive of Hewlett-Packard. He's a psychiatrist. He stopped that. He got married.
To a woman.
So I think those are the people he was around. So when he was writing it... And
speaking again, to that crowd.
Speaking to that crowd. That's sure. that's why it feels that way.
Sure.
But if we look at the level of drag queens, if we look at someone who's brand new and from the beautiful people who just won... drag race or, you know, there's different levels of that drag, correct? So sure. we have some drag queens who are down here at the bottom level. They're trying to get validation.
We talk about buyer's remorse. Anybody who's worked in the service industry.
Yeah.
When they order at the restaurant. Excellent choice, sir.
Yeah.
And part of that is said, Mark, why do we say that to the customer?
Say what?
Excellent choice.
Well, it's because, you know, sometimes people buy it and then afterwards they're like, oh my God, I don't know if I do the right thing. And so they mm-hmm. start getting antsy about it until the food arrives or maybe even after the food. So if you just tell them it's like, oh, that tastes really good. Then they're like, oh, I can breathe easy and just enjoy myself now.
Yeah. And part of that, we say that to the guests. And part of it is we want to be very grateful and appreciative to them for coming on the show.
Yeah.
But there's always... Every single time they're saying, oh my God, did I do well? And you know, marking it to a certain point, we're just like, we have to tell them you did great.
Right.
You know, I think you did great.
I think you did.
Thank you so much.
But I don't want it to come across as insincere or placating you.
Yeah,
either.
No, not at all. Well, that's part of the work I've done. I'm at a point now that I don't need your validation. I give it to myself.
Are you sure?
No, absolutely. Sometimes there's levels. I mean, how amazing it is to be sitting here with you guys is amazing.
It is amazing.
I'm very proud of you. The work you guys have done for 15 years mm-hmm. is absolutely amazing.
You know, this Velvet Rage will take you far in life if you just know how to ride it.
Absolutely.
Make it your bitch.
Well, that's what the Kirk, you know, William Shatner's character in Star Trek: The Final Frontier, Spock's brother, who's played by an actor who was actually in Boys in the Band. He was one of the only surviving actors from that Broadway production that became a film.
Yeah.
Most of them died from AIDS, actually. He becomes a character who becomes leader of a cult that is seeking God because he has a vision that later on has been implanted in his head by this alien who's pulling starships into his remote trap, like a Venus fly trap, to feed off their energy.
Mm.
But we don't discover that until the end of the movie. So Spock's brother is this sort of like shaman who is, I guess brainwashing to some degree, as is portrayed in the movie, by making the characters releasing their pain and suffering. And Kirk turns to him and says, "Our pain and suffering is what makes us who we are. I don't want my pain taken away. I need my pain."
Well, yeah, I mean, isn't our
velvet rage what makes us fabulous? Why would you not want to be fabulous?
Well, I mean, I think that, again, it's not a problem unless it's a problem, right? Mm-hmm. I keep going back to that with myself when I look at, because the only one that I can work on is me. You know, I'm not trying to change the world. I'm just trying to be better than I used to be. I don't want to feel those feelings I had before. Part of our fabulousness is our mistakes and our pain and our learning. But some of it's bullshit too. Mm-hmm. And when the story is in there and it's, you know, someone says, "Are you going to wear that?" And then we snap off just the one little slight. Mm-hmm. And when you snap like that at whatever level you're going to snap,
mm-hmm.
and then you end up fighting over the night over it, that's when it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, find your tools is what I say to people. This one started my journey. It was exactly what I needed to hear. And then I went, I just kept taking these steps of really looking at things. And now I'm asking people three questions three different ways. So this is really good. I'm going to ask you both of these. And
okay. I'm here, baby.
Viewers, you can do this too. Okay. I'm going to ask you three questions three different ways. You're going to measure this with your own.
So there's nine questions.
Yeah, kind of.
oh, shit.
So
we're running out of time.
We got to wrap it up.
So. The work you've done this year, mm-hmm. all the work you've done in this moment, has it been enough? Just measure that somehow for you. Mm-hmm. You know, got it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you happy with the amount of work you've done this year?
Okay.
Just give it a measurement. Okay. And do you love the work you've done?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The people in your life, have they been enough this year?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are you happy with them? Just measure it.
Okay.
And do you love them? Now, here's the hard one. Are you enough? Are you happy with who you are? And do you love yourself? Measure it. Did you measure yourself lower than the work and your people?
Well, I have to remember Alexandra Billings saying, "Who you are is good enough."
Right.
But
right.
Having that, you know.
I came up with 7 inches. Is that the right answer?
7.5 cut.
Having that on a plaque hanging in your bathroom, crocheted, is one thing. Put it into practice is an art form.
Exactly. So when I ask this to people and if they measure themselves lower, like if I look at you two and you measure whatever measurement you gave yourself is probably not even close to where I would measure you. Right.
Mm.
But we do. We have this. We will devaluate ourselves. We'll just.
Isn't there some nobility in being humble?
Sure. And I'm not saying in an arrogant, conceited mm-hmm. or that dick in the White House way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just I want to be better than I used to be.
Sure.
So I'm doing the work to be better than me, not mm-hmm. anybody else. But I do notice that I used to really my numbers were low. They were really low. And that sucked. So I found beautiful books like The Velvet Rage, Untethered Soul, Internal Family Systems Counseling that really gave me a sense of peace and confidence. And I mean, confidence is sexy, right? You see a person, it doesn't matter what they look like.
Yeah, I know you're swimming in men.
Right.
And women.
Yeah, why not?
They're all like throw themselves at you.
I'll try anything now. I'll give anything a go once or twice.
Well, you do have a very a sexual energy about
you. I do now. I didn't before.
No?
Well,
you told people like, "Hey, I play the butt a snuffleupagus." Yeah. They got their boners raging.
Well, you talk about puppetry and everybody just thinks fisting.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I've tried.
I'm classy.
Yeah. No.
I have really big hands, so I haven't found anybody who's willing to.
We're hand brothers. Hand brothers. Yeah. I know a few people that I can bring over.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Folks, we're starting a whole new series on Velvet Rage here at Feast of Fun, and we rely on your financial support to do this kind of show. If you have a moment, please go to feastoffun.com/donate or consider becoming a Plus member, where you can listen to the podcast before everybody else does. You can access the brand new series on Velvet Rage. This episode, The Phantom Menace, is made possible because of you. Nobody else but you. Your financial support makes the show possible, and we thank you so much for it. Mark Salzman, you can find and connect with him on social media, right?
Yeah, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all of those. Just find you guys. You can find me through you, right?
Yeah.
Or we'll put a link to your Facebook on the show notes.
Great.
I mean, if you want people messages.
Yeah, well, no. They'll
be like, show me your dick.
I talk to probably hundreds of people a week from around the world, actually. And
How so? Or as a therapist?
They find me on Facebook. This work that I've done, this passion, I want to help people lead a better life. And if they want to ask me how I did it, I can share it with them. I can walk them through those three questions.
Sure.
Just getting someone to feel that you are not valuing yourself as much as I would value you. And just look at that. Look at how does that feel in your body? It doesn't feel good. So just, and it's a rehearsal. We're practicing being less than we are. And again, not in an arrogant, conceited way, just better than who you used to be. And it's a practice. It's a rehearsal.
Mark, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, guys.
It's a beautiful message here. The book is Velvet Rage. It's available anywhere on Amazon, Apple Books. You can actually buy the audio book, too.
Audible. I do a lot of Audible books. Listening to Alan read that, it's really great.
There's an audio book everywhere audiobooks are found, and Alan actually narrates it really beautifully. And, you know, and definitely does feel sometimes like you're watching an episode of Good Times where, like, Mama, I got a scholarship. I got a new job. We're getting, it's moving to a new fancy house. And he gets run over by a truck and he loses the scholarship and everything goes to hell.
Oh.
Damn.
Again, I'm really proud of you guys. I'm really proud of the work you've done all these years, and I feel very special to be here.
Well, listeners like you, we'll keep on going.
Keep it up.
Come on, baby. Velvet Rage. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Take care.
Bye.